Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, episode 40 for March 19th, 2013. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I am happy to have you with me as always. This is the third and penultimate edition of my series of shows called The State of Games. Third, because I've already released the first two, which I hope you'll listen to. And penultimate, because there's one more to come. And, you know, I just like saying penultimate. Penultimate. See, it's fun. Say it with me. Penultimate. In this episode, I speak with author, critic, and newly minted game writer Tom Bissell. Tom's been a guest before, and he always has interesting things to say about games and other things. As I mentioned in the recording, we were also to have been joined by Gus Mastrapa, truly one of the most knowledgeable people I've met, but very out of character for Gus. He didn't show up for the recording, and Tom and I explain why in a minute, so keep listening. I should mention one more thing. I'm releasing this episode on the day that Gears of War Judgment hits the shelves. Tom and his writing partner, Rob Auten, wrote the script for that game, but we recorded our conversation a few days ago, so we definitely talk about the game, but we don't go into too many details about it. If you're planning to play the game, you'll encounter no spoilers here. I hope you're enjoying this series of shows. If you have a moment to post a few words about the podcast on iTunes, I would greatly appreciate it. My stats show that that's how most people access the show, and I think curious podcast window shoppers are influenced by those reviews. If you have a moment, that'd be great. So, thank you for listening, everybody, and away we go. I am delighted to welcome back Tom Bissell to the podcast. Tom, great to have you back. It's been a while. It's been too long.
It's been way too long, and I would like any of the people in your audience who have heard me on your show before note the relative richness and compression of my voice, because the previous times I've been on and I've listened to the show afterwards, I sounded like I was speaking from the Cave of Despair or something. It was just this echoey voice that just went nowhere. I cut in and out because my internet was sucky. So I'm in a much more compact, carpeted situation now.
This is good.
I'm in a much different place. So I hope my voice is as rich and welcome as yours always is. You always sound like a combination of whiskey and bear rug coming at you. It's great.
Yeah, I get to do post processing on my end. You know, whatever you send me goes in, but for myself, I can, you know, tweak myself up and make myself sound like Orson Welles, you know.
Okay, but I want you to be totally straight with me. In previous times I've been on and you've gone to listening to me afterwards and you're putting the show together, do you think, my God, what a mistake I've made? I know you have.
I've had way worse. Okay. Yeah, I actually have had way worse. I've had, this goes back some, but early on, I was doing like people on their cell phones with me because they didn't have Skype, or, you know, this was before like everybody was really using Skype. So, yeah, some really dicey connections I had with people. Well, Tom is the author of several books, including Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter. He's written about video games for Grantland, ESPN's sports and culture website. And of course, he's published essays and feature pieces in The Atlantic and The New Yorker, other venues, in addition to his own other books. I was thinking, you know, Tom, before we started talking, if anyone's listening and they have never read your work, your recommendation might be different, but my recommendation would be that they check out your latest book, Magic Hours, which is a collection of like 10 years of your writing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's 14 essays. First one published in 2000, the last one published in 2011.
Yeah. And it's entirely focused on the creative process. So, you know, there are chapters devoted to everyone from like Hemingway to David Foster Wallace, Jennifer Hale,
Werner Herzog.
Werner Herzog. Yeah, that's quite a panoply there. But it's terrific. And in fact, I would recommend it to teachers. The creative process, you know, like that's such a cliche, even just that phrase, the creative process in a way. But what I think is great about the collection of essays is that even though they're about these wildly different people, there's this sort of amazing coherence about what that process is all about and how common it is among all those people.
Well, thank you. I have to say you are very alone in that opinion, because many of the reviews criticize the apparent gerrymandered way that, you know, that the subtitle tried to glob them all together into a coherent package. But I don't know. I thought they were all more or less coherent. I mean, I had tons of other essays to pick from, and those are the ones that all sort of rhymed, you know, so.
Yeah. Well, you are solo tonight with me because, and I can actually announce this because I saw he tweeted about it earlier tonight, Gus Mastrapa, who had signed on, was ready to go. He gave me a little warning. He said, now, by the way, I probably shouldn't commit to meeting you at GDC. I'm not sure how it's going to go, but I have a baby arriving. And so he didn't want to commit to this or that, but the podcast would be no problem. Well, we got an
email. There's another Mastrapa in the world.
There's another Mastrapa. There is. And we're all just delighted for him. It's everybody's good. The baby's healthy. Mom is good. He was, you know, just elated, you could tell in his message. So he can't join us for like that particularly important reason. And so we thought, well, you know, we'll just go without him and get him on next time.
So, well, I would like to give you a scoop.
Oh, okay.
A Gears of War scoop.
Ooh, la la. Bring it.
What do Michael Abbott and Gus Mastrapa both have in common?
Oh, I think I might know the answer to this.
They are street names in a section of Gears of War Judgment. So there's one section of the game where anyone who follows like video game writing will see a lot of very familiar names in the street signs. And it's one of my favorite little moments that, you know, it's a total just throwaway that Rob and I did just out of total goofiness and to attempt to buy off the video game reviewing population to look at the game favorably. But we you know, threw in like 20 different people that we knew or liked or read, and you know, like six of them got into the game, and both of you guys wound up in the game. And there's not a moment where I walk by the street sign that says Mastrapa Street that I just don't instantly start smiling. So I hope Gus is listening. Congratulations, Father. You're a lovely, beautiful man.
Yes, he is. Among the most lovely and beautiful I think I've ever met. He's a cool guy. Well, that's great. Yeah, that street sign thing is going right on my Vita. I'm expecting a promotion. This will probably kick me up to the notch here at the college. Well, we're going to be talking about this gargantuan, lumbering title theme of these podcasts. It's sort of the state of games. And I don't mean to suggest in any of these conversations that we're going to, you know, get it all explained for you. But I'm trying to talk to people who come at the question from different perspectives. And of course, you know, you immediately leap to mind because you don't have a single perspective, really. I mean, you occupy this interesting place where you've worked as a critic, as a journalist, as a person who's enthusiastically advocating for games, and then suddenly, boom, you're on the other side of the fence, and you're writing Gears of War, and you've got probably, I'm guessing, a whole evolution of your thinking about the state of games based on that duality. Is that fair to say? How has your thinking about games changed since you kind of crossed over to the other side?
Well, I mean, I'm still on the other side too, because I still review games.
Right.
Which puts me in a weird spot. You know, the more you sort of go over to the dark side of development, the more people you meet and the kind of harder it is to find games that you're not, I don't know, in a position, you know, in a non-partisan position to review. But at the same time, I review books by people I've met, you know. And like a friend of mine, a game developer, found out I was reviewing a game that kind of had some surface similarities to Gears. And he said, isn't that a conflict of interest? And I thought to myself, well, no, because I review books from, you know, my publisher sometimes. I review books on similar subject matters and books that I've written about. So it's funny how in games, this onus of being unbiased, it doesn't cross over into my other world, which is that of like, you know, literary stuff, and how those two worlds so often have a lot of things in common, but the things they don't have in common, they really don't have in common. And you know, that's been one of the big fascinations of the last couple of years for me, is kind of beginning to chart those things out. I find it endlessly interesting. But in terms of my perspective on, you know, where games are, I can honestly tell you, I don't think I've ever been more confused about where games are than I have been over the last, like, you know, year and a half.
Yeah, that's been a real theme in these other conversations I've had. I mean, it's really, this is a real hard subject to talk about because, like, what are you even talking about? What is the game industry? What does that even mean? With all of the channels, all of the sort of modes of communication that the medium is capable of?
The growingly elastic idea of what a quote-unquote game even is?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's something I think a lot of us have been thinking about. And have we, like, painted ourselves into a corner in a certain way by this moniker that we're kind of stuck with forever? That, you know, I mean, when you can't find a game element in a game, is it a game? And then does it matter? Does it, since we call everything a game, then maybe it's just we don't even think about that or examine it. But does it matter what we call them?
I don't think so. You know, in fiction writing, like, the strict definition of a novel is sort of drifted from one archipelago to the next for the last few hundred years, and that doesn't seem to take anything away from novel reading or writing. So I actually am very content with a world in which Dear Esther is a game and Gears of War is a game and, you know, Fez is a game. They all kind of share a nucleus, right? Which is this idea that there's a participant. There's someone that is coming into this system and interacting with it. And to me, that's just enough. I mean, that's enough to make it relegate it to the same phylum, I would say.
Yeah.
But it's a big phylum these days, with a lot of branches and a lot of species. So that's how I would put it.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of almost like an old Hollywood movie kind of cliche, this sort of trajectory of the kid who arrives in Hollywood and he's grown up loving movies his whole life and it's a big deal for him to be there, and suddenly he makes it in the industry and then suddenly everything turns dark, you know. I'm wondering, you know, you've been a big fan of games and you've written so enthusiastically about them, even, you know, sort of warts and all, you just sort of are kind of hardwired to love this thing. Has your picture of it grown any less sunny or hopeful since you've become more intimately involved in the creative process inside the industry?
No, quite the opposite, actually. I mean, I think, you know, when I saw Adrian Chmielarz and his new company, The Astronauts, announce their new game, this is The Vanishing of Ethan Carter, I looked at that and thought, you know, that a game that looks as evocative and interesting and sort of artisanal as that is coming from the people who did Painkiller and Bulletstorm. It just filled my heart with warmth, you know, to see Steve Gaynor, who did just an amazing piece of DLC for Bioshock 2, go on to his new game. It seems to me like the mayhem portions of their careers are kind of over, and these are, you know, amazingly smart, amazingly talented, thoughtful people that are trying to actually do something that, you know, John Blow advocates, which is make games that actually mean something on the level of the human soul, on the level of human existence. And that's not going to stop. And that's the thing I'm most optimistic about. And I really do think in 10 years, games, whatever stigma is left sticking to them, is just going to be gone, because all the people that are coming of age right now are going to be making games about all sorts of things. And that, I think, is really exciting. And I think the kind of violent outlaw image of games is always going to be there, just like it's always there with, like, rock and roll is always going to feel a little dangerous, right? But there's just going to be people that grew up with it as their cultural oxygen, that it's going to seem totally normal to make games about really grand statements about what it means to be alive. And
yeah.
So in that sense, I'm hugely optimistic. As for the business side of games, I think that is a stranger, more complicated question.
Yeah, and that's been another theme that's kind of arisen in these conversations. It's hard to talk about the business, because once you get into the sort of AAA space, it's pretty dicey, it seems, at the moment. And this transition period we're in, it's hard to predict. I posed the question earlier to Chris Sullentrop and Steve Gaynor. I was sort of playing devil's advocate, but, you know, we're looking at a couple of big consoles coming out for a bunch of developers and publishers who don't seem to necessarily be yearning for new hardware, as far as I can tell, and to a consumer base of gamers who don't seem that interested in having them. that particular part of the industry where, you know, the big names and the big games, the kind of the stuff you see at E3 driving the industry forward, is it sustainable in your view?
You know, what I've heard is that the kind of mid-sized studio is really what's endangered in this jump to the next generation. People like Epic are going to be fine because they have their engine business. People like Bethesda are going to be fine because they make, you know, games that are big. They make the best versions of a beloved game genre that they do better than anyone, and they're going to be fine. You know, you can go down the list of other places that are probably going to be fine, but it's kind of the middle tier developer that makes super really interesting games that could be crunched a little bit harder. And I have heard several people prophesy kind of a great bloodletting that this next generation is going to lead to. And it's not like the last few years have been bloodless. I mean, look at all the people that have gone out of business.
Yeah.
And it's heartbreaking and horrible. And I mean, just that THQ sale. I don't know if you read that long post from the dude who worked at Vigil that was on NeoGAF about, you know, what it felt like to be one of the companies that, you know, people didn't even bid anything on. And he wrote about just looking around his office and, you know, how horrible it felt to pour your heart into, you know, a couple games, in his case, Darksiders, and then have the, you know, world of commerce tell you that what you did amounted to literally nothing. Hmm. And it's rough. I mean, you know, I've written books that didn't get published, and I've spent a lot of time on things that have failed, but that's, failure is a little bit easier to handle when it's private and, you know, solitary than like a group endeavor that involves families and dozens, if not hundreds of people all coming together to throw all of their imagination at something. And then it for all just to go poof.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot more of that ugliness to come. And whether or not that'll be a good or a bad thing, I don't know. But I think, and I say this as someone who wrote the newest Gears of War game, but I think we can all agree that whatever games are doing right now at the highest commercial level, the AAA space, has kind of stopped being interesting. I'm pretty sick of shooters, I've decided. Not Gears. I love Gears. But the kind of hyper-realistic military shooter, I don't know. I find them really mind-numbing and not in a good way.
Yeah.
And but people keep buying them, and they're going to keep buying them. And so that is something that I don't really have any tools of prognostication that would allow me to determine what that means. But I mean, Black Ops 2 is what? It's the best-selling game of all time now, isn't it? Or no?
It's close, yeah.
It's close, yeah. And you know, none of the gamers I know, none of the developers I know even really played it. And I actually heard it was kind of interesting. That's the other thing. I heard it actually took some, you know, risks relative to its commercial ambitions. It actually did some kind of, or tried to do some interesting things. Haven't played it, wouldn't know. So I don't know. Are you sick of shooters? Can we talk about that? Is that something we can talk about?
Yeah, I think the fact that you're sick of shooters is more interesting to me, because I've been sick of them for a long time. And I got to admit, I was never really into them huge. I mean, I would play the big sort of marquee titles, sort of just to be able to keep up, you know, and to be able to sort of stay in the conversation. But they've never been kind of my cup of tea. But they have been yours. And I know, you know, you wrote a piece for, was it Grantland, sort of seven ways?
13 ways of looking at a shooter.
That came from a sensibility that sort of really, really knows what the shooter genre is all about and who's loved them for years. So hear you say you're sick of them. That seems to be sort of a big deal. I've got a classroom of students who grew up playing these games, and they're pretty much sick of them too.
Yeah. Well, Kirk Hamilton wrote that interesting thing that one of the reasons beyond just commercial inevitability that people keep cranking out shooters is that, you know, shooters present a number of problems in game design that people have gotten really good at solving, right? And so it's like any new game, when you're kind of trying to figure it out, presents you with all these issues that you've got to deal with. And if you just start plugging everything into like readily available and pretty well worked out shooter problem templates, it's just much easier to start.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just much easier to start making the game when a lot of the engine work is already done for you. Mm. There's still lots of shooters that I've really enjoyed. And, you know, the game I'm looking forward to more than probably anything right now is Metro Last Light.
Yeah.
So it's not like something. Shooters do something that is super interesting, and as I wrote in Extra Lives, like a lot of video game breakthroughs have come out of the shooter. 3D movement. The shooter has been the manger of all sorts of, you know, messianic breakthroughs in game tech. And that is kind of interesting that the game that I think the general public would look at as Satan Spawn has actually done things to the medium that have actually been hugely beneficial in all these ways.
I mean, I'm guessing one of the big reasons you're interested in the new Metro game, I am too. It's one of the few shooters that I loved. I mean, that I absolutely was kind of knocked out by the first one. I'm guessing you're not interested in it because it's a shooter, but you're interested in because of what they're doing with that genre and that sort of their unbelievable sense of place and atmospherics and the little things that happen in those places that the game presents to you.
Yeah, I'm just a sucker for atmospheric games in general. And, you know, whether it's a game like L.A. Noire or Insanely Twisted Shadow Planet, you know, atmosphere to me is what games do better than anything, better than any other medium. So if a game's got a really stylish, unique sense of atmosphere, I mean, I'm already, you know, willing to pony up my love. So
do you think that's part of the reason why sort of new spaces opened up for developers, that games have always been able to take us to other places? A lot of that work happens in our imaginations. And, you know, even the Mushroom Kingdom it's a place and you can imagine it. But in the last decade or so, what that means, how games can take us to another place or put us in that world, we are so able to do that in interesting ways now that it's like a clever designer with a story to tell, or someone who wants to think ambitiously, artistically about what to do with these tools that I can build things with, probably is going to think, I don't need to make a shooter. I could make something else and bring my audience into this particular world. And that sort of in and of itself is so ripe with possibilities.
Yeah, well, look at John Blow's new game. It's a first-person puzzler. You know, it's in the language of the first-person shooter, the visual language. You walk, you come into contact with the obstacles that you must get by, except you're not shooting anything. You're just solving line puzzles. And I just going to go out on a limb and say I think it's going to be a hugely important game in all sorts of ways. And I'm dying for it to come out because, you know, I've played a bit of it a few times, and I think it's really going to be one of the legendary hand movers. You know, if the video game medium is like a clock that sort of, you know, rusts to a standstill every few years, I really think that The Witness is going to push one of the hands forward a bit.
He's in a position that's a little similar to yours, I think, in the sense that he has been openly critical about games and the industry and various things at the same time that he's working creatively on a game. So it puts, whether this is fair or not, puts a little bit more pressure on him, maybe a lot more pressure, to sort of deliver the goods, if you know what I mean. You're in a bit of a similar position, aren't you, writing Judgment? Do you feel that?
It's kind of crazy because people say to me, so have you figured out, is this the storytelling breakthrough that you projected in Extra Lives? And I just want to say, are you fucking crazy? It's a sci-fi shooter. No, it's not a fucking storytelling breakthrough. I mean, we tried to make the best Gears game we could. And I say this as someone that worked on the script of the game and, you know, worked hard on that, but I didn't have anything to do with the important stuff, which is just how the game looks, feels, and plays, right? But I can say it's just a really terrific, intense third-person shooter, and I really love it. And I really hope it's smart and fun and relatively charming and has a, you know, pretty crackling story. I really hope all those things. I hope people respond to that. But there's really only so much you can do, you know, from a storytelling perspective in that frame.
Yeah,
we tried to do it as best we could, but every time someone asks me that question, if this is the game that is going to be the one that solves the problems that I outline in Extra Lives, I just think, how could it? I mean, how could you ever imagine a Gears of War game or a Call of Duty game facing up to like these huge systemic problems of game design? I mean, the people that are going to do that are not working in the AAA space right now, because the games are so expensive that how on earth could you ever convince, you know, a gigantic nervous company to give you enough money to fund a colossally expensive game that was going to redefine the parameters of game storytelling, they would giggle and then show you to their office door and then have a straitjacket waiting for you when you got there. So I love action games, you know, I do. And I really hope, love to keep working on them. But then this is the other interesting thing. If you're a person who wants to write video games, my advice is learn how to make them yourself, because you're never going to be able to tell your own story you're burning to tell. If you don't know how to make the game, you're never going to be the person who's given the keys to the castle. It's just not commercially feasible that that would ever happen. And so, I look at myself as a hired gun who tries to do the best, smartest, most elegant job possible in the parameters that I'm given. But I kind of wish that when I was 12 years old, I got really interested in computers and learned how to code, because my life might have been a little different. Hmm.
You know, it's interesting that, I mean, artists know what this is all about, the idea of working within a genre and sort of loving that genre and then tailoring your own voice to it, that there's a kind of cool challenge to that. The constraints are sort of what make it interesting, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking like Skyfall, for example, the new Bond movie. I mean, they bring in Sam Mendes to do this movie. He's not going to turn it into a musical.
No,
he's not going to make it a quote unquote Sam Mendes movie, or he's going to work within the confines of the genre, not because he's like some oafish slave, but he's actually kind of treasures the idea of getting his hands on this really great tool set or toy box, really, if you want to think of it that way. And he makes a great movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Best Bond movie ever.
It is. It is totally the best Bond movie ever. And what he did was function like a professional director. I mean,
yeah.
The best sense of that word.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great example. And God forbid, I'm not going to compare myself to Sam Mendes, but I think if you're coming into an established franchise like Gears with the people who, made all the other Gears games, you're just trying to make their vision, as good as you can imagine making it,
yeah.
I guess is how I would put it.
So has the perception of what you do or how games function in our culture changed? For example, somebody I would imagine who cares about your work as a writer must have said to you at some point, oh my God, what are you writing about games for? Why are you wasting your time writing about or now writing for games? Has that changed? Do you find more enthusiastic sort of understanding or support for what you're doing as a writer?
Well, that all really wildly varies from person to person. I have a couple writer friends, respected, well-known writer friends who basically regard what I do as selling cigarettes to 12-year-olds. And I will kind of gamely play devil's advocate and argue with them as to that, this is really not that different from, William Faulkner writing Land of the Pharaohs for Samuel Goldwyn. But, I actually think I care a lot more about games than William Faulkner cared about pharaohs, or movies for that matter. So I get a little bit of weirdness from some people about it, but it's not like I'm not writing the other stuff too. So I just carry on living this kind of strange bifurcated existence, in these two very different sort of cultural realms. Actually, it's kind of interesting, and I wouldn't trade it for anything, but I will not argue with you to say that it does lead to some singularly strange moments for me.
I want to have you back on, you and Rob Auten, your co-writer for Judgment, to talk specifically about that game after it's released. So I don't want to go there too much. But let's follow up on that comment you made earlier about I wish I'd learned programming and I wish I could have thought about being more in control of the creative process to really be able to tell a story. What sort of advice would you give someone who sees himself or herself as a storyteller but wants to use the medium of games to tell those stories? And what are the opportunities? What are the limits of that for you? Or why would an artist choose it over another channel? Does this question make any sense?
It does. And I will just say what I've said to a few people, young people who said, I want to write big budget AAA games. And I will tell them, I don't have the faintest idea how one does that. I'm a fairly established writer, right? And I had to bang my head against the door of writing for games for several years with a lot of no responses. And for whatever reason, a lot of game developers want a screenwriter. they want a comic book writer. And this is probably another conversation, but I happen to believe that game storytelling has way more in common with novelistic storytelling than it does with film storytelling. We can get into that later, but I feel like screenwriters are in many cases the worst possible candidate to write good game scripts. And yet, these are the people that all big honcho game developer guys want to hire because it gives them cultural cachet and it makes them feel legitimate. But I don't think those people help them get any closer to what they're trying to do. And I think screenwriters are uniquely situated to write the worst possible game script because they're addicted. Many of them are addicted to all this kind of storytelling Scientology of like this Robert McKee, Sid Field, three-act structure bullshit that bears no resemblance to any kind of conception of story that I'm familiar with or that I'm comfortable with.
But the story arc, Tom, the story arc.
All that stuff is complete. It's complete horseshit. And I will say this till the day I die. It is complete horseshit. story is the stately presentation of a bunch of stuff that happens. And there are so many different ways to do it. And the slavish adherence of the average game developer to Hollywood logic about what makes a good story has damaged this industry so profoundly. And it has kind of limited the emotional register of what games can do profoundly. And I really believe that. And I really hope that more and more people are realizing that that's true. Like one of the few good screenwriters that has written games is Alex Garland. But guess what? He plays a shitload of games. He is a gamer. So I feel like he's one of the few people that kind of gets it.
Yeah. So who is it that's making games these days that interests you in particular? I mean, you mentioned John Blow, obviously. But when you think about going forward as a writer, who would you want to work for? What sorts of games interest you, or what kinds of games would you see yourself wanting to focus on?
Gosh, let's take me out of it.
Yeah, okay, that's fair.
Let's take me out of it, because that's not germane here. The designers off the top of my head that I like really respect. Obviously Clint Hocking, as you know, I adore that man. I think he's incredibly interesting and good, and I await with bated breath whatever he wants to do next. I think Phil Fish is super interesting, and complete nut. Based on Indie Game, the movie. Jason Rohr is someone that I have an immense amount of respect for. I think Adrian Schmielarsch is an incredibly brilliant guy that I was lucky enough to work with a bit on Judgment. I think Ken Levine is incredibly, incredibly smart and was lucky enough to get to talk to him a bit about Infinite a few months ago. Just hearing him talk about like how he got to where he got and how many chucked games it took to get him to where he got.
Right.
I realize that he's basically a novelist that just happens to make games. And a novelist who happens to make games is maybe the worst kind of thing to be because it just takes you a lot of drafts to get there. But, when it's novel writing, the only expenditure is temporal and like maybe paper-based. But when you're a novelist emotionally who's making games, the expenditures are massive. So Infinite is a game I'm dying to see come out because I really hope it gets the reception it deserves because it's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant thing. I really like, we're talking about game designers we like, right? Suda 51, I think, is so amazing. I will even forgive Lollipop Chainsaw, which is one of the worst games I've ever played. But everything else he's done, I find like endlessly fascinating. God, I mean, you're putting me on the spot.
But this is good. This is actually a good list. And I just round these people up. And, we could go on. I mean, there are other people we might explore. Yeah. But, I mean, I'm guessing then, based on these names that you've suggested, that you would advocate for the idea that there is, in fact, a kind of an auteur function for a game designer, that despite the fact that it may require hundreds of people to make a couple of the games you mentioned, huge teams of people, disparate, some of them that never even meet each other, that there's someone at the core, sort of at the center of it, who really is the sort of the spine of the project.
I am not sure I believe that. In fact, I'm pretty sure I don't. I don't think auteurism in any collaborative medium is true. Rob and I argue about this all the time. Rob thinks the director is the guy. I happen to think the film editor is the guy. Sometimes I even think the person who scores the film is the guy. So I don't really buy into auteur theory very much. I think someone like the people that I mentioned are people, if they're working on like a big budget game, they're just people that somehow manage to attract or get the best work out of equally talented people. And they just happen to be the ones whose names are at the top of the
But you, you would agree, I'm guessing, maybe you wouldn't, that the names that you listed pretty much all have what you might call forceful personalities, that these are people who tend to have very clearly articulated point of view about what they want to do, what they want to make.
Yeah, I would say that. But, I don't know, actually. I've never worked with any, I've worked with Adrian, but... I don't know. That's a good question. You've stumped me, Michael. You've stumped me.
Well, I mean, I don't know whether they're auteurism or whether even this question matters, but I think one bit of evidence for auteurism, of course, would be to sort of step back and look at the body of work from a particular designer. Suda would be a great example because he's got such a big, obvious set of fingerprints on his games that there is, in fact, a traceable set of obsessive concerns that, you know, that artists have that they just won't let go of over the course of their career. And you can really trace it to them, or it could just be a stylistic thing. You can just tell a Tarantino movie, you know, within 8 seconds.
Yeah, I do think that's true. But I also think that people like Tarantino or Suda attract hugely talented adjutant figures that are willing to martyr their own artistic primacy upon the altar of the project leader. And, you know, if anything, working in games has taught me that if any, you know, the person who really steers the ship is the producer,
because
they're the ones that are making the calls ultimately that determine the course of the game. You know, Rod Ferguson is just one of the most wonderful people I've ever met. And he was at Epic for, you know, a good part of the project on Judgment. And then he moved over to Irrational to help Kent Levine ship Infinite. And, I mean, Rod is not someone that would say, oh, I'm the artist, I'm the, you know, expressive person. But he makes the calls that actually allow all of those, quote-unquote, artistic decisions to actually blossom and come to fruition. And so that's kind of the thing I learned, is, like, the huge influence a good producer can have on a project, which fascinated me, because producers are really boisterous and have... they need to have forceful personalities, but they're also the last person that would like instantly stand up with their hand in the air when they asked, who's the artist in the room here? You know, they would sort of slink away from that.
Right.
But they're kind of the people that allow the artists to stand up and hog all the credit, you know, during the triumphant parade at the end of a game.
Yeah. That I remember talking to Matthew Burns about that.
He's a producer. Yeah.
Yeah. And the mindset that's required to sort of keep all those balls in the air at once, it's really kind of an amazing engineering mind one has to have. But that idea that you step away at the last moment when, you know, let's presume that Infinite turns out to be a great game. You know, you're going to be seeing Ken Levine and well deserved. He'll be, you know, on covers of magazines and he'll be interviewed. And in some ways, I suppose Ferguson must just step back and sort of enjoy that from afar.
Yeah, I think he'll enjoy it from a near too.
Well, I'm sure. It depends on how we. Yeah.
And I think Ken would be the first person to like say, you know, Rod is the, they brought Rod in to like ship that game, and he did, and it's incredible. You know, I mean, Rod saved the first Gears from, it was like a rudderless ship, and you know, he went from Microsoft to Epic to like basically create a workflow schedule, and he did it. And they came out with Gears, which had been like a drifting ship for a couple years, and he righted it, and the game came out, and it was like a groundbreaking game.
Yeah.
And Infinite 2 was I don't know if it was troubled. I don't have any awareness of that, but it definitely was a lot farther from a release point than it was, you know, even a few months after Rod arrived. So. To me, it's evidence that the game production process is way more complicated than auteur theory would allow for.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Well, let's take the business side of things out of the picture and just think about games moving forward. What is it that makes you hopeful about where we're going. You mentioned earlier this generation of kids, really, who are coming up who've sort of never known anything but that interactive tether in their lives, and how that may sort of parlay that into some creative things. Why should we be hopeful about the future of games? I see a lot of hand-wringing online. People say this thing's going to crash and burn any minute.
I mean, what do they mean by that? I mean, let's unpack what that means first. Crash and burn in what way?
Well, I think maybe, obviously I'm pitching it to sort of load the deck on one side so you can counter it. But there's kind of game culture. Games and the design of games aside is still kind of deeply problematic, I think. That it's just hard to hang out with gamers sometimes because they still are kind of mired in some pretty twisted up attitudes and an odd kind of defensiveness about some artiste coming in and stealing their toys. I find a lot of resistance among students who should know better, who I think ought to be more open-minded about what games can be.
Well, give an example. Like, what do you mean?
Well, for example, I mentioned this in another segment. I wrote a fair amount about Journey when it came out, and I love that company, and those designers, and I've had them on the show. But I'll be damned if I can get any of my students to play these games.
What? Your students don't play Journey? What the fuck's wrong with them?
I don't mean to suggest that not a single one of them plays. I might have sort of cavalierly said, I can't get a single student to play it. Well, that's probably not literally true. A few students have played it. But I mean, just my general success pitching these crazy new games, you know, these indie games to people that ought to be kind of ready consumers, you know, young, open-minded people, right? 19-year-old connoisseurs of games. They've grown up with games. I still find it rather difficult to get them to take their eye off the AAA space. It's a little bit easier on the other end of it. An iPhone game, a little throwaway thing, they're all playing those. That's easy. Have you tried this? Yes, I'll download it. It's 99 cents. It's that middle place that I'm finding it rather difficult to get much momentum going with them.
Well, I've said this on your show before, but the problem with games is gamers. Tons of my friends are gamers. I'm a gamer, but nothing makes me angrier faster than talking to gamers. And I say that with a certain amount of flummoxed love and affection. I was with some gamers semi-recently, and I listened to this heated debate. And these are like a lot of game journalists, a heated debate about whether a game was an 8 or a 9. And I wanted to slap them in the head. It was the most pointless discussion I had ever heard. They may as well have been priests in like 5th century Byzantium arguing over whether or not angels could eat. You know, that's kind of what it felt like. Just a completely wheel-spinning, pointless discussion that had no relevance to anything other than the own, like, crappy machinations of their own minds. And, you know, I'm living in dread of Metacritic right now because, you know, I have a game that I wrote that's coming out. And I mean, the influence of the Metacritic mindset is just so poisonous. It's awful, and it bleeds right down into everybody. Dead Space 3, right? It's, like, at a 77 right now. I played it and loved it and gave it a really good review. And, you know, I read the pieces on Kotaku about, you know, Dead Space didn't sell well and Metacritic is low. And I just was like, my God, this numerical... I mean, Metacritic has never even disclosed how it comes up with half of these numbers, right?
Yeah, they've given a kind of a mystical explanation. And they got defensive a couple of years ago and kind of... they published something that sort of said, well, here's kind of how we do it, as I recall. But I don't have any details exactly how they work or who counts and who doesn't count. There's a lot more international sites that they count now than they used to. I know that.
It's not Metacritic that's the problem. It's the industry that attaches any value to the Metacritic scores. Mm. That's the problem.
We've talked about this, and it's easy to get into a kind of fist-shaking, you know, conversation about Metacritic, but... I mean, in the trenches, you know, where people buy games, games sort of live and die in at the market level. It's extraordinary how powerful it is as a metric of quality.
Yeah.
I mean, it is the default go-to. My students will regularly claim that game X is a better game than game Y because of the Metacritic score. It's at 8 points higher, you know, without any kind of critical reflection on what that really means. And these aren't idiots. These are pretty smart, you know, people who just seem to have a general sense that, well, look how many people are critics. It's actually a reasonable measure. It's like 30 different people weighed in. They're really smart. They write about games all the time. So
this is seems to me unique. Like Hollywood Metacritic affects, but it doesn't control. Metacritic doesn't exist for books. Why the game industry has allowed Metacritic to rule it to such with such a cruel hand is one of the great mysteries of modern industry. But we're getting off track. Let's talk about more interesting things. A minute ago, we were talking about games that give me hope, and I think a game that doesn't have a great Metacritic that a lot of game critics, in my opinion, missed the boat on. They didn't even miss the boat. They weren't even on the same continent the boat stopped at for them to get on was Papo and Yo, which I think you and I had a very similar reaction to. You wrote incredibly beautifully about your tormented relationship with your father. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, definitely. That was a very hard game for me to play. That game took a toll on me.
Yeah, I have a father that I adore and love and even wrote a book on, and my father's an alcoholic. And I finished that game, and I was sobbing like a kid.
Yeah.
I couldn't stop crying. And it was all that last sequence where, you know, he takes the boat, the sky boat across, and he loses his robot toy, and he has to sort of decide how, you know, what his ideation of his father's going to be. I found it like amazingly powerful, and I accept that it's not a very good game, that it has rough edges. But seeing game critics write about that game, I have never wanted to like crumple up my computer more frequently than reading reviews of that game, talking about, well, the puzzles are uninteresting. There's clipping at certain parts of the game. And I was just like, guys, yeah. Guys, you know, it's like they couldn't have a more holistic approach to what that game was trying to do, or a more realistic acceptance of the tiny number of people that made this immensely beautiful work of art, and look at it not as this like checklist of things to check off, and just as an experience that you just open yourself up to, was hugely disappointing to me. And I've never met the guy that made it. Xander, what's his name?
Yeah, I met him at E3, actually.
You did, because you told me right after you met him, and you let's break the fourth wall. You came back to my place, and we were talking about you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was – he was inundated with people for a time because Sony was just pushing, like, every possible, you know, journalist at him. And, I mean, that's got to be a real double-edged sword. You know, Sony is – they get that game out there. They put it on PSN. It becomes – you know, it's a real platform that's going to get much more notice there. But, you know, what the price you pay for that is, I'm sure he just had to give up a certain part of his life, a certain part of his privacy for a certain amount of time until everyone was pleased and he did all the publicity he was supposed to do. I thought in some ways, too, it was a shame that he had to be so forthcoming because part of the promotion for that game was about him kind of spilling the beans about how autobiographical it was and how, you know, it came from a very personal place. And I don't think he dragged his feet on that. I mean, I think he was quite.
Yeah, I mean, he dedicated it. Like the epigraph of the game is to like to my family who survived the monster of my father. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's
absolutely. But I felt like in some ways it was a shame that we had to be told so clearly that the game was meaningful, you know, that the game was, of course, I found it to be utterly meaningful, but the fact that I just think that some cynical game reviewer types probably sort of thought, okay, well, let's just see how meaningful it is then, you know? Oh, look, the puzzles don't work. Or like, wow, that was an easy puzzle. This isn't that good of a game. Sometimes I think that one of the great problems we have enticing people into the game design space is the reception that they might get from the people who know best about games. If a JRPG comes out, I want Jason Schreier on that game. I want to know at Kotaku what he thinks about it because that guy knows his shit, right? He knows his what he's talking about, and I'm going to read that very carefully. But if you want to make a game that doesn't seem to fit anywhere, it's possible that somebody like Tom Chick or somebody like, you know, Kirk Hamilton will step up and say, wow, I just found this game like nobody's seen it or it's gotten very little notice and kind of champion it. But it's also very possible that that game just won't, or that that artist who makes it will actually never make that game, because it's hard to find the space for the critical reception it would need to be able to sell. So sometimes I think that the industry is bent against innovation and creativity, partly because of the nature of how we respond to games. Even in the Twitter space, I think it can be very constraining.
So are we coming down on the fact that game criticism has some blame to bear here of the confusion in the place that we're at?
Well, I think it's the difference between game reviewing and game criticism, and that it's really sort of a call to arms in a way to say, look, if you want to be a game critic, I think we're at the place in the evolution of games where game critics can't just be sitting around waiting for the next game to come out so that they can type up a blog post about it, but that they must be forcefully advocating for innovative games. And by that, I don't mean like the newest game engine or the newest tech, but games that try to do or say different things. And they've got to push that space open wider and, you know, bring people to those games more aggressively. I don't think you can just be that cool, objective critic on the sidelines, sort of picking out the good stuff. But you need to kind of be in there, you know, dragging people into it and encouraging people who might have been discouraged by not getting the kind of notice or attention they wanted. You know, go to Indiecade, go to these other places and champion this. You know, get people to pay attention.
Well, now you're making me wish I'd written about Pop O'Neill for Grantland, and I should have, but I didn't.
Chris Solintrup, he mentioned that game, that very game earlier when we talked today, as one of his he said it was the best game of last year.
Mark of the Ninja was my game, best game of last year.
Now, there's a great example of a game that's been, hopefully those guys feel very encouraged by the response they got. That game did very well. That's the nice edge of the sword of Metacritic, is those guys got such a nice Metacritic number that they're very likely to be encouraged to make another game and go even farther with that. What else makes you hopeful?
What else makes me hopeful? I think whatever the next systems are, whatever they can do, there's going to be some real cool spectacle games that are going to come out pretty quickly on them. And when I say spectacle games, I mean games that are going to, like, imagine L.A. Noire, except that had a world that was worth exploring. And I think that's what we're going to see. We're going to see open world games are going to obviously hugely benefit from these next systems, because, I mean, the constraints that the 360 and the PS3 are under, like, memory-wise, now that I have a little bit more awareness, you know, the kind of, like, shocking memory limits that these games had to deal with, and the fact that they were as good looking as they were and like ran as well as they did. Now that I know like exactly how much memory a boomer in Gears of War takes up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so I, you know, early on in Judgment, we were talking about something and someone mentioned boomers were memory hogs. And I was like, oh, why is that? And then it was explained to me, like, their AI behavior coupled with the gun that they hold, the way that this kind of slow moving shell lands and explodes, and the blast radius that you have to like measure for when the boomerang hits, and like how all these things just add up to being to like making like a character that's a memory hog. I remember sitting there and thinking, that is the most interesting thing I've ever learned. Like when this big lumbering blockheaded monster that says boom walks out onto the screen, you've actually just taken like a, you know, 8% memory hit across the entire, you know, whatever your operating memory is for that particular section
of
the game.
Right.
I remember just thinking, wow, that, because we have this completely naive illusion, you know, me and a lot of other gamers do, is that, oh, it's games, you can do anything, let your imagination run wild, but this rather tricksy fellow memory is always dogging behind you. And that, to me, is, like, super interesting. And it's kind of like trying to write iambic pentameter, you know? You have the seeming illusion of being able to say or do whatever you want, but the demands of metric and rhyme just weighing down at you at every corner.
What percentage of the constraints that you face as a writer, then, on a game like Gears of War Judgment are purely technical? and which are just, you know, creative limits or you know, that's not the story we want to tell, or we don't want to go there.
With Gears, they're almost all technical. I mean, 99% of them are technical.
Yeah. So what you ultimately have to do is, I don't know, rein in is probably too negative, but you have to understand where you can go and where you can't go and keep it inside that circle.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And it must be frustrating to some degree, right? I mean, you must have ideas floating around that you just simply can't, or roads you'd like to travel down that you just simply stop.
Yeah, no, we did. And, you know, Rob and I were throwing out all sorts of ideas early on when we were thinking of levels and stories. And you know, when the schedule for the game was pretty tight. And asset creation, there's one. Asset and prop creation. Oh, God, this is so interesting. So after we wrote our script, our cinematic scripts, I was looking around in the Perforce kind of shared archive, you know, that they have. And I found this document no one had ever showed us, which was someone had gone through our script and identified all of the unique props that would be needed in the cinematics.
Of course.
Like a swinging chandelier, a gavel, a book, just things that we mentioned in the script. And I just thought, oh, someone will just, you know, oh, they'll just appear in the cinematics. But no, someone had to go and make them.
Yeah.
They had to make them. They had to, like, design them and put meshes on them and, like, figure out how they fit, you know, into the scene, and then, like, assign all these values and properties to them. And I found this memo and I looked at it and I just thought, I know nothing about this process. And it was fascinating, and it was a real eye opener, because just mentioning a chandelier resulted in hours and hours and hours of work for a couple people at Epic.
Yeah.
That's fascinating, isn't it?
It is fascinating. Yeah. Yeah. And it argues what you were saying before, is it's actually, you know, bringing in some hired gun with who understands how to write a screenplay, maybe have nothing to do with what you need to know to write a game.
Yeah. It's a lot easier for some production scout in Los Angeles to find a place that has a chandelier in it than it is for an artist and a programmer to figure out, like, you know, I mean, the Unreal Engine is well enough along that you can, you know, it's not terribly difficult to create a chandelier and figure out how one would swing during an earthquake or whatever. Spoiler alert, but it's not an earthquake. I got educated pretty quickly in the fascinating limits that are put on the purer storytellers on the team from the people that actually allowed the storytellers to tell their little story.
So, do you have time for one more question?
I have time for five more questions.
We're before the release of the game, and this is a kind of a interesting place, I think. A lot of us who look into the game industry from the outside, I would imagine we wonder, like, what's it like in that period where the game is done? It's been done for a while. It hasn't come out yet. And you're just kind of all just sitting around waiting for that to go off, you know? And in this particular case, you have an audience, a devoted audience that's built in. It's not a new IP, but you're clearly trying to do something different with the franchise. I know this is kind of a sort of a bad generic question, but what's that like?
What's it like is that it's really interesting. I've had books come out, and you know, you wait on the New York Times Book Review, which is the review that is the one that can make or break your book's, you know, perceived success. And I've been extremely lucky in that sense, in that most of my books have gotten good New York Times Book Reviews. But, you know, with a game, there's no one arbiter, right? You're going to spread this out over several dozen websites. As someone who's not an employee of Epic, as someone who's a contractor, I have somewhat less skin in the game, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
But I have my own, you know, sense of pride in my work to like, really want it to do well and really want people to respond to it. And I think the coolest thing is going to be when I log on to Xbox and I'm going to see of my 100 friends, how many of them are playing it. And you know what's going to be the funnest part? It's going to be jumping into a game with strangers and running through the game with them.
Yeah, that would be that would be pretty cool, actually.
That's going to be pretty great. Yeah. And because guys at Epic do that all the time. They told me when Gears 3 came out, half of the people I worked with told me that they, for several weeks, they were just jumping into games, into squads, and like listening to people play and like not giving away who they were. It's a little harder for me since my game handle is, you know, my Xbox Live tag is my name, but it's not like, you know, the average Gears player, you know, gives three shits about, you know, who wrote the game. So,
yeah, yeah.
We shall see. So I'm like excited, a little nervous, but it's a weird feeling. I mean, I haven't really had anything to do with the game for like 5 months now. Well, that's not true. Like 4 months. So all of the like really complicated polished stuff happened sort of beyond my experience. So I don't really even know what the finished game feels like yet because I haven't played it.
Yeah.
I've played like the 98% version several times, but I don't know what the 100% version feels like. So I'm nervous. I'm nervous.
Yeah.
Grobs and my goal was trying to write a game for the best version of our like 16, 17-year-old selves. And that's what we tried to do.
That's interesting. How do you channel that?
Well, you know, we're men. We all have a chaotic 14-year-old boy running around inside of us. You know, a few game jobs I've been up for, I've bumped my head into this perception that I'm too like refined or literary to like really understand. And you know me, right? So that, you know how absurd that is. I mean, you've seen me play Just Cause 2. And, you know, that's what I said.
Yeah.
Like, I remember what it was like to be a chaos-minded 15-year-old bastard, and that's kind of the person you have to tap into if you're writing, like, an action game, because, like, rock and roll, these games are not for adults. They're they're for naughty children in the most wonderful possible sense of that word.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's fun. I think that's actually great. And that's why I love Grand Theft so much, because... You know, I think one of the lines that I'm proudest of in Extra Lives is that most games are about attacking a childlike world with an adult mind. The Marios, the Zeldas, etc. But GTA is about attacking an adult world with a childlike mind. And there's something about that that I find really exhilarating. And Gears does that too.
Yeah. Yeah. And probably if we wanted to pursue it, you know, psychologically speaking, it's cathartic. There's something important that happens there that's probably really healthy for us.
I think so.
Long run.
long run stuff, yeah. But it doesn't change the face of video game storytelling. I'm comfortable admitting that.
So what will change the face of video game storytelling?
I'm looking for someone to do a game that... You know, involves the kind of shit that AAA games do, characters, story, etc. But it doesn't involve any conflict. And people say that's an insoluble problem because gamers need conflict. And you can hear my voice going, so it kind of sounds like to me that I'm about to start crying, and I just want to assure your audience that I'm not. It's just that my vocal cords are weakening.
Yeah, and we should mention before we started, you told me you were a little hoarse, so...
I was hoarse, yeah. I was a little hoarse. And if you've seen Top Secret, you would be laughing right now. Because that's a hilarious moment when the little horse comes out. Let's just play... Let's do this before we go. Let's do an Imagine a Game sequence. And I'm trying to imagine a game like Skyrim, like Mass Effect. These big, kind of endorphic... wonderful world-building games that involve these fascinating people and places that you go to. What if you didn't have to fucking fight anyone?
Yeah. Yeah.
What if you just went around and just, like, talked to people? Wouldn't that be cool?
It's kind of like taking the core, most fun things about, like, the Dear Esther Proteus approach, which is just, there's a world, go walk around in it.
Yeah.
But populating it with the things that... don't have to trigger action, but could trigger other more interesting things in the player or in the game world.
Yeah. Right? And yeah, here's what I'm excited for. Here's what I'm hugely excited for. I think the days in which a game company hires a writer to write a so-called script in which there's cutscenes and then gameplay and then cutscenes and then gameplay. I think so. Basically what, you know, I am doing right now is an endangered species. I don't think that's going to be around for much longer. What I think the future of interactive game storytelling is, whether on like a more indie level or a AAA level, is going to be not screenplay morphic conceptualizations of game storytelling so much as interlocking storytelling systems that are much more created on the fly by player decision in ways that are way deeper than we can currently imagine. Imagine a game, let's just forget if it involves combat or not, but let's just imagine a game in which you have a partner, an AI partner, and let's imagine a game in which that partner responds to how you actually behave, how fast you run, the things you look at, the things, and rather than like selecting a line of dialogue that then they cue off of, but reacting to you on way more subliminal levels. And I think the next generation of systems are actually going to get us closer to that kind of experience. An AI partner or an AI presence in the game that's actually able to respond to the deepest, subtlest version of your gameplay self. That is a thing that makes me really excited. And that's where I think game storytelling is going. Interlocking systems that express themselves in ways that feel like traditional storytelling but are not. That are actually way different than that.
Right.
And they're all written and they're all directed and they're all like wrought by a quote unquote creator, right? But they're wrought by people who are arranging them to be equally evocative no matter what contingency is enacted. And that's my big complaint with like binary morality systems, that there's always like a good ending and a shitty ending. And the shitty ending, the ending that most people don't pick is always the one that has that, like that they threw together in 5 minutes. And I'm talking about like a series of possibilities, narrative possibilities that are all equally interesting, equally produced, and you know, that are just that are built right into the system. Will actually be able to generate itself on the fly as to how the game responds to you. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, I'm imagining. Let's say that systems that would underlie that work. All right, and that was built, and so the engineering of how to make such a game happened. I can imagine, just off the top of my head, my wife and all her friends and many of my male friends as well, if someone told them there was a Downton Abbey game, and really all you do is just go into that world and you can send out invitations and have a ballroom party in the mansion on Thursday, and your friends can come visit and you can interact with them, and then you could, you know, fire the maid and hire the next one, or and then suddenly like you could switch characters. So I don't want to be him, I don't want to be her now. And it's a sort of persistently alive world, immediately compelling because there's got like narrative stuff inside it, but also kind of meta stuff from outside that you bring with you to the game from the, you know, the television series.
Yeah,
I'm just imagining all kinds of ways that could be
awesome.
Wildly interesting.
And that to me is the future. And I think that's one of the reasons that the Walking Dead games are going to be some of the most important games of this generation. Because these are games with, I would say, shitty to god-awful gameplay in the pure sense of that word, but are absolutely absorbing and completely wonderful. And they get you there just by how deeply they committed to making decisions matter, making interesting decisions, and like giving you choices to make that were horrible, you know, that they actually, I want to go back and play it again just to like make completely different choices. And that's a weird thing to want to do, but you just want to see like how deeply they committed. And I know they must have committed pretty deeply.
Well, the evidence of that game, the impact of that game was just the conversations that you had. I mean, I've never had conversations with my gamer friends around here like I had about that game. I had students texting me, and I don't give my phone number out to very many people because I don't like students to text me. But I have this little core group of guys. We were all playing that game together. I was in a hotel room in Chicago, and I had tears coming down my face. And I was texting with a student who had just finished it like maybe 20 minutes before that. And we were just commiserating about what we had just seen and done. And that's never happened to me before playing a video game. You know?
Yeah. I think the moment that I felt grabbed by that game is when the dude at the end of episode 4 suggests that Lee get away from Clementine. And I responded very angrily. And I looked over at Trisha, my lovely partner for life, who I looked over at her and she had tears in her eyes. And she was like looking at me and she's like, it feels weird to talk about it, but she recognized my paternal ferocity.
Yeah.
You know, I think the game was suddenly speaking to both of us on this purely biological level. Like Trisha as the, you know, potential future mother of my children, me as a potential future father of her children. And we were suddenly relating to each other, you know, basically as like these purely biological procreative machines. This game had tapped into a part of us that wasn't even, it wasn't intellectual at all. It was just purely emotionally biological. And God, how many times has that happened to you playing a video game?
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Not very many.
No. And I didn't see it coming. I isolated myself from all the talk about that game. I did not pay attention to anything anybody wrote. Any sniff of it I got on Twitter, I ran away from it. I mean, that was the purest discovery of a popular game I think I've had in a long time. Mm. You really have to insulate yourself actively these days. It's hard to not bump into people talking about it. But
well, you have to get off Twitter is step one. Admit that you have a problem.
Well, listen to the segment I did with Lee Alexander earlier. We talk about Twitter quite a bit, and yeah. We came to that very conclusion. It's a very difficult place.
It's horrible. Let's just say it. It's fucking horrible.
But you know, okay, but the upside is, look, how did I find out about Gus's baby? Boom.
On Facebook, obviously.
No, I don't do Facebook.
I think we have to go now. Now we're crossing the, I have the red lightsaber of Facebook and you have the blue lightsaber of
it's true.
Twitter. And we're just knocking them together to no good end.
Well, this has been a great conversation as I expected it would be. I appreciate your.
Well, it's been 1 hour, 31 minutes and 50 seconds long. And I'm worried if we bored the audience.
Well, I'll edit it down to about 20 minutes. How's that?
Why would you even say that? That just makes me more self-conscious.
Well, I really appreciate your time, and I know you tried to cover a lot of stuff. I don't know how to wrap my arms around this subject, to be honest with you. I just wanted to kind of get a picture of where we are and what you thought about kind of the state of games from your perspective, and I think that's exactly what we did. So I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure as always, Michael.
Best of luck. Happy gaming. Thanks for joining me again.
Let me know when you want me to come back. I'll be here.
Okay, will do. Take care.